from MLU headquarters in Philadelphia.
You should go underneath it.
Oh, way out deep!
This is Cleats and Cuffs.
Hit man! Oh, what a one! Murray!
Everything ultimate, from the field to the boardroom.
Hey, you got this?
There?
Oh, yes!
Hello,
Mr. Graham!
And welcome to Cleats and Cufflinks. I'm back here with Dusty Rhodes, my constant companion in this bit of nonsense that we call Cleats and Cufflinks. How are you?
I was going to go with a journey, but
journey.
We can call it a bit of nonsense
bit of
if
nonsense.
You like, because that's not really an insult.
No.
Specifically for someone like me, who is a great lover of Alice in Wonderland.
The most beautiful, I think, homage to nonsense in the English language, I would say.
Is it nonsense or is it... off sense, is a different sense. Anyway.
I was just talking about Alice in Wonderland the other day and Through the Looking Glass. I think a lot of people only have experienced those through like the Disney movie.
With the cars that fold.
Which is great,
yeah.
By the way. A very good representation of it. Or through, I think there was a new movie that did not do well.
Oh, with Johnny Depp.
Yeah. Did you see that one?
Of course I did, because that was the time when we thought that Johnny Depp could play any strange character and make it worth your time.
Did he prove that wrong?
Let's just say the movie isn't necessary to watch again. If you're interested in Johnny Depp involved with Alice in Wonderland, you can do better watching Finding Neverland, which he was also in.
Okay.
Which was a little bit before, a little more serious, not quite as Tim Burton-y. Because Tim Burton can go off the rails sometimes.
Tim Burton gets a little bit aggressively Tim Burton.
I mean, he does some genius work, too.
No doubt about it. No one's questioning
that. He gets led places.
Just shark jumping is what we're talking about. But yeah, if you haven't read the books, though, read the books. The books are excellent. But yes. Anyway, getting from that point, we're here on Cleats and Cufflinks. Season is coming up, and Dusty and I were talking about problems. because that is generally what one tends to talk about when one is leading up to a season that's only a month away.
Oh, it's coming quickly.
Yeah, problems pop up. And we certainly have some of them. We fix some of them. We continue to fix the rest of them. But the bigger point was we got to the idea of problems in general.
Mm-hmm.
And we started talking about what is the primary problem to be solved when playing Ultimate.
Well, you have to get from literally point A to point B.
With point A being?
Well, point A, where the disc is, generally with a thrower.
The thrower. I'm going to call it the thrower. We're just going to accept that
and,
for now.
And point B generally being caught by the new thrower on your team.
Call it the receiver for the sake of
argument. For the sake of definition and clarity.
So we have a point A is the thrower, point B is the receiver.
And generally... the goal is just to get to the end zone, but you don't always get to do that one pass, so we need to involve multiple iterations of this same problem.
There are many different ways of attacking the problem of point A to point B, always while trying to avoid point D, who we both agreed is Del Rico Johnson.
Right. Point D, we weren't sure if it was point D or point D'd.
Yeah.
So it's just this scenario where you always have to imagine that someone is out there hunting a block on every one of your throws. And if you go with that in mind, both as a receiver and as a thrower, you're starting from the right spot. Doesn't mean you'll end up at the right spot.
No, absolutely. And the thing is that the thrower has a significant set of problems presented before them.
There's a time
to
limit.
To solve that basic problem. So you have a time limit. You have a mark. You have a defender downfield.
Sometimes
you have a cutter
marks.
Who doesn't necessarily know they're open.
It's one of my favorite cutters, the one who doesn't know he's open.
You were talking about that before. As long as you hit them with the disc, you've done your job.
If you as a thrower hits your receiver with a disc, you are absolved of at least 5% of the responsibility. You still chose to throw to someone who wasn't going to see the disc, but you can still point at them and say, you know what? Nobody intercepted that on the way. You probably should have caught that.
Eyes here. Eyes, here.
Right. Eyes on the prize.
Put your eyes here.
I'm the prize.
I'm the prize.
This frisbee that I hold, this is the prize.
And then as a receiver, you have a similar set of problems. You have to get open. You have a mark on you. You have a time limit. All those things. You have the boundaries of the field. Like it's a quantifiable problem, right? And every quantifiable problem has a set of inputs, right? The data inputs. Where's the mark? Where's the defender? Where's the sideline? How far downfield, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to talk about a couple of the instances, though, where this line gets a little blurry.
Hmm.
And one of them is that for a lot of throwers and for a lot of people in general, the one parameter was, this is the hand I throw with.
Right.
And that was a defined thing.
Yes.
This is my pivot foot. This is the hand I throw with. I have to break down this problem using that.
Right. So these are the tools that I've got at my disposal. You've got your pivot, so you can move around, get away from the mark. And you've got this thing where you are convinced that you can throw with one hand. First, to back up that a little bit, let's think about the Frisbee for a moment. If you toss the Frisbee up with even just a little bit of spin, it throws. It tends to do a throwing thing as opposed to a fluttering, flipping about sort of thing.
It's not a horseshoe.
Right, so it's built to sit in the air and spend time up there and follow a path, hold spin. And all, like, once you throw a Frisbee, you start to realize that it's built for a very specific purpose, throwing and catching. So while you've got that, you've got this tool that can do all of these things. If you try to throw it the same way that you throw a baseball or you throw a football, those are more complex tasks, actually, because the object itself doesn't help you. Mm. A baseball is built to fly and be hit, sure, but it's not built to float. It's not built specifically to be thrown and to be caught and all of that. So you've got this tool to start with that's very versatile. You can do many things with it. You can even scrape off your car in the winter with it. You can drink things out of it. You can eat out of it.
Yeah.
You can carry things in it.
I've done all of these things.
You can make great circle tracings if you want to.
Yeah, I think about the difference between a Frisbee and a ball is that a ball seems to have accepted its subservience to gravity, whereas a Frisbee is reluctant to cede its position. And it does go to the ground, obviously.
Ultimately.
Many times when I throw it, it does. It goes there eventually, but it seems like it's going to fight it on your behalf for as long as it can.
It's not in a hurry.
It's not in a hurry. at the very least, it's not in a hurry.
So then, once you're being helped a little bit by the object that you're using, one of the things that we all start to do as throwers is you start with the backhand, and then you learn the flick pretty quickly thereafter, so you realize that there are multiple ways to throw it. Then you start throwing hammers and scoobers and thumbers and push passes and just weird little high-release flicks, high-release backhands, low-release, inside-outs. You've got all these air bounces that are not really my taste, but some throwers really do fundamentally incredible things with them. But so then if it's that easy to throw and you can do that many things with it, what would happen if you try to use your hand that isn't as good at throwing things? This isn't new to sports. It's not as though basketball players only ever use one hand. It's not as though soccer players only ever use one foot. You tend to have a dominant foot. But they're all, like, a competent soccer player can complete passes with both feet at some normal
distance.
It's
funny because this gets talked about actually a lot in these sports as well, right? You always hear about a player who is more two-footed than another player,
right. Or
more right-side dominant, more left-side dominant. Same in basketball. You hear about players like Steve Nash learned to dribble with both hands super early. You can't even tell I don't know what hand he is, to be perfectly honest.
Vaguely right-handed
is apparently what it is. He doesn't shoot that often, so it's hard to really read it. But it's definitely still a conversation in those sports. But it's accepted that at least a certain level, everyone who plays a given sport should be able to hit the ball with their left or right foot, should be able to shoot the ball with their left or right hand, or at least dribble it with their left or right hand.
And pass, for sure.
Yeah. So ultimately, it's been very interesting where it's gotten very one-sided, almost tennis-y in a way.
you wouldn't advocate that someone should learn how to hit the ball from both sides in tennis, because you've worked on your two-handed backhands, you worked on your two-handed forehand. Like, it's a sport that's evolved to this point where the way that you're striking the ball each individual time, it's so difficult that your offhand can't do it. The ball isn't helping you. The racket's helping you a little bit. But so we're working from this assumption of players can only throw with one hand. And we've started to bake that assumption into offenses. We've baked that assumption into the way that we interpret rules. But if you back up and you say to yourself...
I baked it into playing defense. I mean, I counted on people throwing... When somebody threw with the other hand, it throws
it
you
It catches
off.
You off guard.
Yeah, no.
So that's the thing. If we back up and instead of saying the tool that we have is everybody can throw with one hand, because everybody can throw with one hand. But if we back up and say, can everybody throw with two hands... Then you look at the problem slightly differently. So when we talk about throwing forms, when we talk about pivoting, and we talk about extending all the way out on your flicks, which is something that you all need to practice. You need your low release, step out flick. That's key to have. But the reason that you're stepping all the way out there is also because you aren't using your other hand to pressure the defender. So the sort of pivoting styles and disc holding styles that we've developed over time is something that is specifically weighted toward one hand or the other hand. If we back up and try to change it from the ground up, if you teach players that they can throw back short range backhands with both hands to start with, and they work from there, what sort of throwing forms are going to develop? As opposed, like right now, a lot of players who work on their offhand, they work on specific offhand throws. So like, well, I'm going to fake a flick and then toss this little lefty backhand over the shoulder, as opposed to doing it naturally and just doing it as, oh, the space is open, I'm going to throw the lefty backhand or the righty backhand there.
And I'll give a shout out here to when I transition to this mode, because you're right, like it's not the full set. Can you get the full set on both sides? Can you get the full thing? But even then, the thing that I always find interesting, because I thought of this because you brought up that flick to the little backhand.
Yeah, and that's the first one that just about everybody does.
Everybody loves that one, right? I think I'm going to shout out to Brian Cleary, who I played with here in Philadelphia for years, old Germ Circus member.
The Germ Circus, yes. I came across them at many tournaments.
Yeah, just a, wow, that, well, train wreck.
But train wreck in almost like a positive sense. It's like, we know this is going to be a train wreck.
Yeah.
And that's what we would like to see happen.
And some of it is just a just glorious train wreck.
It's a team attitude.
And talented players. But anyways, Brian made that play a lot. And one of the things he did, and something that comes up when we talk about being a two-handed thrower, is he didn't set a pivot foot. So when he'd initially catch the disc, he'd be standing on both feet, not moving.
Right.
And his first decision tended to be the throw he made. And it could go anywhere at that point. And I think that's when you said pressuring the defender or pressuring the mark, the opposite of what you think of when you think of a mark.
Right.
You think of them pressuring the thrower. But the thrower at the same time has to be pressuring the mark. That creating that moment where possibilities are wide open is a huge amount of pressure on a mark.
And this is something that most ultimate players don't learn to take advantage of. We're always taught to set our pivot quickly and then step out. If you slow down for a second, specifically if you do like a two-footed jump stop, which is something you're taught in basketball, for example, because you know, you can avoid a travel in a very specific context. But if you land with both feet and don't pick either up, both are valid pivots until you choose. So delaying that choice gives you more options to solve whatever problem comes up as a thrower. So even if you want to step with your wrong, incorrect foot and throw like a baseball player throws, you have that option available to you. It's the same thing. We used to have a teammate, Dan Heckman, who would always walk up to the point where he's putting the disc into play with the disc in his right hand. Dan is incredibly left-handed. Can't do anything with his right hand, but he would walk up and hold it in a way that you would think, if you hadn't played against him enough, that he was totally right-handed. Not true. But you can manipulate it past that, considering the rules that we have in Ultimate. So you can just make your mark not know which hand you're going to throw with. I coach a player on John Doe right now who's really taken to throwing lefty backhands. And you don't recognize that he's even doing it because it's a normal throw. It's something he hadn't really practiced before, but it turned out to be something he was quite adept at. So you see him step out and throw this lefty backhand. You're like, that couldn't have been the wrong hand because that looked too easy.
Right.
So it's this thing where the barrier to entry to throwing left-handed is not that high. If you go home right now and throw 10 passes with your right hand, 10 passes with your left hand, both backhands, and alternate between the two, by the time you're done, you will be able to reliably complete a 10-yard backhand pass with both hands. It's that easy. So having this barrier where we shy away from using something that we're not as good with, that's part of the issue here.
I mean, you brought up a good point there, too. It is actually relatively easy, and a lot of players have picked up on this and noticed it. And, in fact, a lot of players use this pretty regularly without us even necessarily recognizing it.
So a lot of times you'll hear announcers say, oh, and he threw that with the left hand. Well, there are a bunch of other times where that happens where the announcer doesn't even notice, or the folks on the field don't even notice. They just know that the disc is in their hands. And my brother, who's coaching some teams up in Rhode Island, has noticed that he has a couple players who have always thrown with both hands. So when he asked them what they had just done when they came off the field, they're like, I don't even know what hand I threw that with. I just threw it over there. He's like, well, I can't tell if you traveled because I don't even know what you did. I don't know how to coach you to do that. You're already doing it. So this is the thing that amazes me. We've talked about whether people would be throwing with two hands or not. They're already doing it. It's on the way. It's just a matter of when we get to this point and how different does it look.
And I think that that's the kind of issue, right? So we have this one side of it, which is this is opening up the player's toolbox. It's putting pressure on the mark. Because a mark, let's face it, a mark is not trying to stop the thrower from throwing. A mark is trying to limit the possibilities of where that throw can go.
Yeah.
That's the best you can do as a mark for the most part. Yeah, every now and then you're going to get a point block, you're going to guess right, you're going to make a right move. But your real goal is the same as a goalkeeper in soccer. You want to cut down the angles. You want to create, you want to limit the amount of places where the ball could possibly go.
Yeah.
And by adding this dimension, you are multiplying the possibilities that that mark has to worry about.
And the very simple way to think about that is if you throw an inside-out righty flick, that takes a path that kind of goes up, goes back down around that way. That's the same path that an inside-out lefty backhand takes. It's also the same path that an outside-in righty backhand takes. So these are three ways that you can get to that same general flight path. One of the other things that comes up is the difference between an outside in and an inside out is the spin relative to the direction that it's traveling, right?
Mm.
So with different discs, they have different characteristics by being thrown outside in or inside out. Like the Discraft disc tends to flatten out and like kind of overcorrect. If you throw it with a bunch of inside out, it sits flat.
Yeah.
The Innova disc, the Ultra Star, not the Ultra Star, the
why
did that blank?
The
Pulsar. They all have the AR at the end. It doesn't do that. It tends to hold on the same flight path that you have. It's a lot more like a golf disc, I think.
Mm.
So whichever one of those you choose is also related to what it is you're throwing. So you can manipulate these different discs in different ways using different hands, and you can manipulate your defender in different ways. So like you can fake that same essential flight path three or four different ways as opposed to just one or two. And it's the pressure you can put on people is incredible. But one of the other things that comes up into this is how do you deal with travel rules?
Well, that's what I was going to bring up.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about that a minute ago, is that, yeah, this is great, right? As a thrower, now I've developed all this much wider set of tools, better way to break down my mark. But now we get into that rules question, and both from the club aspect where the players are kind of all refereeing this thing, but also from the MLU aspect where we have referees, they're going to be stuck with this same kind of problem. When is a pivot foot established?
It's such a big question.
Yeah.
To me, the way that I think about pivot foot is it's almost like a limit function in math, where it's like, you decrease to this point where it's essentially zero, and the last thing that is touching the ground, that's your pivot. Until you get to that last thing, you have multiple pivots. So you're constantly decreasing the number of pivots you have until you're stuck with one spot.
So most of the time when I caught the disc, I had at least an elbow, another elbow, one leg.
Right, laying on the ground, possibly using the person laying underneath you as your pivot to begin with.
Best case scenario, yeah.
So the one of the things that happens in most of the time is we're associating right-handed throwers with a left-handed pivot foot because
yes.
This lets you step out and throw that flick from further away from your defender.
And so if you were refereeing, be it from a player perspective or an official's
yeah.
perspective, that's the foot you're looking at.
That's the foot you're expecting.
Because, too, you can't get over the bias of knowing that player. You know, you're three-quarters of the way through a game, you've watched Nick Hurenet catch the disc 750 times at that point. Because apparently that's how their offense runs. And you know what foot is his pivot foot. And
yeah.
then suddenly that changes. The inclination is going to be to jump on that as a travel, right?
Well, but it's not necessarily, because more likely than not, you've been giving him the benefit of the doubt in terms of, oh, he's right-handed. He should be able to set his left foot as a pivot foot. So sometimes when you're running in a specific direction, I'm lacking for the exact scenario, you're given by your mark an extra step. So they're like, oh, he's going to set his left foot as a pivot foot. When in reality, if you set a hard cap at two steps, which is a I think, a reasonable number.
We'll have this argument. Because that's a different debate. Time. That's right? A different debate entirely.
But if you set the hard cap at two steps, he would be required to stop on his off pivot foot. This is the difficulty with setting a hard cap, whether it's at two or three or four or five or whatever you want the number is. You have to stop at this point. And if your feet are off, then you get the wrong pivot foot, which happens in basketball, but yes. doesn't happen in ultimate because the rules don't force you to that decision. We let you have whatever number of steps seems appropriate.
This is why basketball is the jump stop, right?
Well, not
because
only
you want to land in a position where you have the opportunity to go either way.
Yeah, and it's that, and it's, well, I mean, you can dribble, so it's slightly different, but ultimate players, by and large, as throwers, have never tried to pivot with the wrong pivot, so they don't know what the advantages or disadvantages are. And if you're pivoting with the wrong pivot for one hand, you're using the technically correct pivot for the other hand. So you're at a spot where you can, if you can effectively use one hand or the other hand, you don't have a wrong pivot. You have a pivot that you choose given this moment or that moment. But so, right, and the thing that it keeps coming back to is, what are the assumptions that we've made when we started to try to solve this problem? We assumed that players could only throw with one hand. Mm-hmm. Or we assumed that there's a correct pivot for
if you're right one hand or left footed pivot, yeah.
And this plays out when you go to like league games or whatever, is like you'll see that one dude who's pivoting with the wrong foot. You're like, he's new to the game.
Yeah, he doesn't know what
he's doing. I can see.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the correct judgment. It's more that he's using his biomechanically correct form that he learned from baseball, and ultimate kind of perverts that. Not in a bad way, but it challenges you to throw with biomechanically incorrect form by stepping with your the foot on the same side that you throw with normally.
I remember how confusing that was when I first started learning.
And it just seems awkward. But it's also what infielders do on the, you know, running in the wrong direction or whatever sometimes. But the question always becomes, what are the assumptions that you brought to this problem? And are your assumptions blinding you to the easier solution? Like, if we're always trying to throw with the same hand, what are we missing if we just take some easy throws with the other hand? And how does that change how the defense respects us?
Yeah, are we using the hammer every time we have a screwdriver in our pocket? That's what you're...
Oh, this is a screw. You mean it's like a nail with ridges around it, right?
Nail.
Right. So you just have to hit it harder to get it going to place.
It's a fact, if you can hit it hard enough. So, all right, you know, we're running the risk of perhaps annoying our audience.
What?
But no, this is important, though. So we had this two-handed thing, and this is sort of the thrower's way of solving this problem.
Right.
Let's talk about a receiver way of solving this point A to point B while avoiding point D problem, which is receiving the disc. Now, of course, there are a lot of things to this. There's cutting, which I'm sure you have lots of opinions on as well. Mm-hmm. There's how there's offensive sets. There's all these different things. But one of my favorites, and one of the things we haven't really talked about in a while, is... sock.
Like 0.6?
Not like 0.6.
Merino wool?
I really love when you plug our sponsor. You did a nice job there. So not sock, but 0.6 socks. Wonderful. Now, sock is an SOC, so sphere of catchability.
Okay.
This is one of my favorite terms in ultimate that I haven't really heard applied in any other sport. It reminds me, though, in a way of sort of a strike zone in baseball that varies by body type. Sphere of catchability being if you throw to somebody, given their speed, their height, their arm length, their jumping ability, their layout capabilities, there is a certain amount of distance you can miss them by
and
where they can still catch it. And this applies to things like football as well. You think about, it was the guy with the Giants who does the catching.
I'm assuming you're Odell Beckham Jr.
Odell Beckham Jr., yeah. That's what I'm talking about. I think that is actually, that's on his Topps card.
That's just his resume.
Do they still have Topps cards?
I'm not sure if Topps specifically, they do still have sports cards.
Sports cards, the guy,
not as many
the,
as they
the Giants
used to.
Who does the catching. but he clearly has a gigantic sphere of catchability for football. Now, an ultimate sphere of catchability is much bigger because, again, the disc is cooperating with you.
It has a handle.
It has a handle.
Footballs really do not have handles.
They do not. Though with the new gloves, it seems like they do sometimes.
Or with the size of your hands, depending on who you are.
Also that.
Let's not get into the presidential written.
Oh, no.
We're going down that quickly.
I was going to tip over the edge.
We're done.
All right, we're staying away from hand size. But the thing is that a disc stays in the air. It gives you a chance to run onto it. It gives you a chance to catch up.
Yeah.
It gives you a chance to correct. And players, though, have a definable kind of range in which they can catch things. And I've known tall players with a small sphere of catchability. I've known short players with a huge sphere of catchability. I was trying to think. There was a good example of a short player with a huge sphere of catchability. Do you have anybody in mind? I was thinking of somebody the other day, and I'm trying to remember.
Off the top of my head, no. I was setting up for something else here.
Who is Tyler
DiGirolamo.
He has a huge sphere of catchability.
Well, he's also huge. I mean, compared to me, at least.
Compared to you.
I'm a little guy.
But I think about people like that, and I don't know why he came to mind instantly, you know...
Well, a lot of times what happens with big players when they have smaller spheres of catchability is they're not as willing to just throw their body toward the disc.
Right.
But actually, a good example of a giant sphere of catchability is Kenny Dobbins. Like if you
That's
go,
great.
Like, if you go watch old clips of him,
yes.
He's climbing people to make catches. He's laying out all over the place. He's like, if you threw a disc anywhere near him at any speed, with any spin, coming in at any angle, his expectation is, I'm going to stick this in my hand and it's going to stay there.
And it's
and that
mine.
Permeated the whole New York dynasty, is that if you hit me with the disc, however hard, whatever angle, whatever, wherever way I'm running, we're all going to catch it. But he was the prime example of that. Some of the catches he's made in high-level games are just absurd. I can't even imagine the things that he did in like lower-level games that we have no evidence of.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's this sort of thing where like you see players do like... You have great teammates, and you watch them do these things over and over and over again. They become less great. But for everybody else who sees them once in a while, you're like, wow.
That's just what they do.
And you're like, well, that's like seven steps below what he did like last week, but
right.
It's not as big a deal. One of the things that related to handedness is players need to be able to catch with both hands. Like, this is something that Jude keeps coming up in these, actually. One of our old teammates was a baseball player at the collegiate level. And his thing was that he tended to catch with his left hand, which is something I also do, having played baseball at a much lower level. Because he was just like, you just put it out here or out here, and I put my hand on it, and then I catch it. And he's like, well, and people would be like, well, what if the spin is different? He's like, what do you mean spin? You just catch it. It doesn't matter what the spin is. You just stick your hand on it, and then it stays there. So being able to use both hands individually to catch high, low, you know, top hand, other hand, doing it however different ways, that's vitally important for players to increase their sphere of catchability, because you can't always reach across your body and use the hand that you want to use.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's something that I talk about when just playing catch. If you're out just like throwing the disc back and forth, catch the disc in different ways. So catch the tailing edge, catch the front edge, catch it underhanded, catch it overhanded. And frankly... You know, people aren't wrong. There's certainly easier ways
yes.
to catch a spinning disc.
Yes.
And there's a right hand to catch different throws if you're given free reign
of opportunity.
The choice, right.
You don't always have that.
You do not always have that. I will say this, but while we're on this Jude topic, behind us today, a little shout out to Pike, 2005?
I want to say, yeah, that's definitely five.
That's 2005. So Pike 2005 jersey is our thing on the list. If you have a jersey and you want to send it to us, let us know. We'll get you the information. You can get us a jersey. We'll put it on our set. We like to collect bizarre ultimate paraphernalia because our office has very little in the way of decorations.
So you do have lots of wall space, actually.
Any way that we can bring that up. But, I mean, there's a huge list of players that have always impressed. Danny Clark, you know.
His sphere of catchability was incredible, very high.
Yep.
But lower down, he wasn't as good.
Not a huge like layout guy. Trey Katzenbach,
similar
kind of player like that. Whereas Joel Wooten, very tall, sphere of catchability on the lower level was astonishing. And I'm
right,
bringing up
right,
old
right,
players
right.
because I'm an old player.
They're easy
and
to think of, right?
Who I remember because I've thought about this with them very specifically. But it's on a receiving end, it's one of the biggest things. You know, you got to improve your cutting. Clearly, like, that's something to focus on. Speed, you can't, you know, affect as much as you can, I guess. Some people naturally have it, some don't. But really, the sphere of catchability thing, catching with both hands is probably the simplest way to build that up, I would say.
Well, there's that, and then there's awareness. We talk about this a lot, and it's you have, whether you know you're open or not, you are open somewhere to a specific throw. Every receiver on the field is open somewhere to some throw.
Mm.
And learning how to figure out where that throw is and trusting your thrower to put it in the right spot and solve that problem is one thing. But if you turn your back on the thrower, that's a perfect opportunity to get beamed in the back of the head by a frisbee. And it's one of those things that you don't want to see it happen in a game, but it's a practice learning tool. It's like, don't look away from me because I can hit you with the disc.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability to just catch the thing as it comes around you, it's vital. Frisbee's a great problem-solving tool. It gives you so many options.
You can do so many things with it. There's plenty more to talk about here. We're only like barely scratching the surface. And I feel like once we add some interviews to this show, we're going to run it back up to the hour mark.
Love to have somebody to talk to who isn't you.
Yeah, wouldn't that be amazing?
The one thing I will mention on the terms of sphere of catchability in baseball is once they started dealing with the range of players defensively,
you see that more.
You start to get an expectation of some players have an expanded range and some players have a smaller range. The picture perfect person for this is Ozzie Smith. Mm. Who you played essentially error-free baseball at shortstop, which is the hardest position to do that. And the errors he would get tagged with were balls that no other shortstop could get to.
Because he's that fast and that quick. His expectation on him was bigger. Yeah, that's probably the most accurate comparison. I don't know why I didn't bring that up in the first place. But anyway, so problem-solving and ultimate for today. Two-handed throwing, two-handed catching. I guess that's
don't throw
much
to don't throw to the D.
Don't throw to Del Rico Johnson. All right. Well, thank you, Dusty. If you want to ask questions to Dusty, you want to get me for next time, you can get Dusty at
DUSTWEETR. Dustweet R.
On Twitter, or you can get me at Nick Darling, NIC Darling, and you can get us both at Cleats Cufflinks. Look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks for joining us.